Bond Charge is one of my favorite holistic wellness brands with a wide range of evidence-based products. And I just invested in a couple new ones, from blue light blocking glasses to EMF management to their new infrared sauna blankets and PEMF mats. Bond Charge has all the high quality and effective products you are looking for. I just ordered the Bond Charge Red Light Face Mask to get all the anti-aging benefits of red light for my skin. It is so easy to set up and use. Red light actually stimulates the mitochondria in your facial skin cells, which then direct your cells to produce more collagen. This can help brighten and firm your skin and reduce wrinkles and fine lines. I also just got their new PEMF mat, which I'm obsessed with. PEMF stands for Pulsed Electromagnetic Field. Basically, it's a mat that gives off low frequency waves that penetrate through your skin, down to your muscles and tissues. It can actually regenerate nerves by stimulating nerve cells to grow. It helps improve immune function. It improves blood circulation and inflammation. And my favorite part, it relieves muscle aches, provides pain relief, and actually activates bone cartilage cell stimulation. I now love to lay on it and sit on it daily. I lay it on my bed and lay on it while I'm watching TV at night. Bond Charge's PEMF mat has different settings for sleep and focus or relaxation. And my favorite part is that they also have red and near infrared light, so you can get the benefits of red light therapy while laying on the mat. And it has settings with far infrared light, just like the sauna blankets, which heats your body up from the inside to improve detoxification and release tension. In other words, this mat does it all. I also use my Bond Charge blue light blocking glasses at night, my computer glasses, to reduce blue light when I'm looking at screens. And of course, I still use my sauna blanket and I love it. Bond Charge has 20% off all of these things. Go to bondcharge.com/wellfed. Use coupon code wellfed for 20% off. That's bondcharge, bondcharge.com/wellfed. And use coupon code wellfed to save 20% off sauna blankets, PEMF mats, red light therapy face masks, and so much more. You are now listening to Well-Fed Women, the show that's been radically changing the way women perceive health, fitness, and their bodies since 2015. I'm your host, Noelle Tarr. Submit your questions to wellfedwomen@gmail.com, and you can keep up with the show on Instagram at wellfedwomen. Welcome, family. I'm so happy that you're here. This is episode number 469, and I have to apologize in advance because this week that I recorded, I was coming off of a nasty cold. And while I wasn't symptomatic, my nasal passages were just inflamed. I don't know, so this is going to be a little nasally. So I apologize in advance. Luckily, I do not talk that much. I do a lot of asking the questions and hearing the answers. Today, I get to interview Dr. Julia Greenspan. I was really thrilled when she came on my radar. She is well known for her expertise in chronic infections. So if you have, like me, you're curious about the signs to look out for, how to prevent Lyme disease, what do I need to know about PANS and PANDA, so that things are on your radar, this is going to be a great episode. I basically got to bring somebody on and ask all of my questions, things that I'm like, well, wait a second, I'm not totally understanding this. And does my kid have PANS and PANDAS? And how would I know that? And are these little symptoms like tics and OCD, like how do I know that that's not an underlying infection? So, you know, we dive into a lot of this stuff. I think it's a good overview for a lot of people, but it also, hopefully a lot of light bulbs will go off for people who have kids or, you know, are struggling themselves with symptoms and they haven't really gotten answers from conventional doctors. Dr. Greenspan is a naturopathic doctor in Amherst, New Hampshire. She actually has a full-blown medical practice. She's been doing it for close to 20 years. She treats patients with complex chronic illness, including Lyme disease and mold biotoxin illness, PANS and PANDAS, long-haul COVID. She's the author of the book Rising Above Lyme Disease, which I will link to that in the show notes. And she integrates a lot of modalities into her treatments, which I just love. So she does IV therapy and medical ozone and herbal medicine and UV light therapies and red light therapy. So she has a conventional medical practice that also has a lot of these holistic treatments in order to bring about health for her patients, which I just love. She does see patients online, which is great. So if you are struggling and you want more answers and you need somebody just to talk to that can validate your experience. She is fantastic. So I am thrilled to get this episode out. I hope that it does help a lot of you. And we're bringing awareness to, I think, conditions that are often overlooked and people who are often dismissed because they have these long haul infections that aren't treated with a simple solution. So people don't know what to do with it. So let's get those answers. So let's jump to my interview with Dr. Julia Greenspan.
All right. Well, welcome, Dr. Greenspan. This is a really interesting episode for us because when I was prepping for this, I was like, where do we even go? Because there's so many things I want to dive into with you. You actually have your own full-blown medical practice. You see people on a daily basis, which means you are like, you are boots on the ground. You're seeing people, you're seeing families, you're seeing kids, you know, on a daily basis, and you're seeing what people are struggling with specifically in this post-2020 world. So I'm so excited that you're here. I appreciate you taking the time to be with me today and answer everybody's questions from our community.
Well, thank you so much. I'm happy to do it.
Yeah. So your specialty is Lyme disease. You said chronic infections, kids' health issues like gut issues and PANS and PANDAS, which they're really, really complex. I have been trying to kind of unpack a little bit more of it and understand more about some of these more complex issues, just as a mom and as a person in holistic health. And it's a lot. So when you opened your practice and started seeing patients 17 years ago, did you know that that's what you were going to focus on? Were you like, Lyme disease, this is it? And what led you in that direction?
So I'm originally from the West Coast, where even though Lyme disease is there 17 to 20 years ago, you know, it wasn't something that was thought of as being there. And it wasn't anything that was part of my reality. I moved to New Hampshire around that time after graduating medical school. My original focus in medical school was environmental medicine, which actually interestingly ties into, you know, kind of leading to Lyme and a lot of the things that I do. And then I also have a background in psychology, which also, again, blends into what ended up being my specialty. But I opened up my doors just to kind of like, whoever comes, I will help and I will help the best I can. And people started showing up with tick-borne infections or positive Lyme tests. And at the time, being a naturopathic doctor, we have prescribing rights for medications, antibiotics, but that really just wasn't the direction I wanted to go. My dad was a pharmacist, and I kind of went into naturopathic medicine to kind of not do that and to not prescribe and to do something more natural, and like the you know, their PCPs can handle that. Well, so I sent patients out and I'm like, go, you know, because I live right in kind of the epicenter or one of the epicenters for tick-borne infection here in New Hampshire or the New England area. And patients would come back and say, my doctor won't treat me. And so then I'm like, well, okay, I guess it's me. And so I started treating patients and, you know, things that were long-term illnesses for them or even just short-term, but completely debilitating, you know, unable to work and function. They were parents, professionals, and they were getting better. And then because there's such a shortage of doctors that sort of acknowledge it, especially at that time, people start finding out that you're the doctor that does it because people were so desperate to find someone who would do it. And then, so I would say that my practice kind of picked me. And that oftentimes is what happens. You have your ideas of what you think, and then it ends up being something totally different, but it was actually perfect for me. You know, it found me and it was actually the perfect fit. So,
wow, that's amazing. So I want to dive into some of these questions that we have. We're going to talk about a lot of chronic infections. And of course, Lyme disease is going to be a part of that. I've actually never discussed Lyme disease in depth on this podcast. So of course, I have a lot of questions. Also, as you know, I live in Northern Virginia. Mm-hmm. Ticks are everywhere. Everywhere. Yes. And they come in from just your backyard. Like it's wild. And it kind of stinks because you want to go for a nice walk in the Shenandoah Valley and do some hiking, but like you got to stay 100% covered up. I actually had a friend's spouse go hiking and just ended up covered and was like, what just happened? You know, it's just not something you necessarily think about. So first I want to know, and you know, we're talking about ticks. I know Lyme is a little bit more complicated than just ticks, but where does Lyme come from? And I know this might be a little bit weird of a question, but when we talk about Lyme disease, where does it exist in the body?
So Lyme spirochetes and the pathogen, the bacteria that we call Lyme, Borrelia burgdorferi, or there's several different strains of Borrelia. Some we've discovered and others are probably, you know, still yet to be discovered. But they've been, it's a disease that's been around for thousands of years. It's been found in, you know, animals or humans that have been kind of frozen in the ice caps and that have been, you know, that we find kind of in ancient ruins or when there's a thaw. They've been able to isolate that. And so it's been here for a very long time. There's a lot of different reasons why and reasons we don't know, and maybe some we do, of why it's all of a sudden now become more aggressive. I would say, you know, one of the major, you know, topics is that climate change. Ticks, basically, they are the vector and they are sort of the reservoir that carries the infection. So the animals, you know, different types of animals carry Lyme, and it may not impact them the same as it impacts humans, but they carry it. And so when ticks are in their nests and they, you know, mom makes their babies, they usually will create their nests around areas where there's rodents or, you know, animals that are low to the ground so that the larvae, we're going to start to get kind of gross here, but the larvae, yeah. The larvae can feed off of mice. And so we think of like deer and larger bodied animals, larger mammals as being kind of the primary vector, but actually mice are primarily one of the first vectors. And so ticks will feed, they live about 2 to 3 years and they may feed, they could go a year without eating, or they may feed a few times a year, but they will feed a blood meal off of a mouse and then take in Borrelia into their stomach and into their gut. And then the next person or next animal that they feed off of, they kind of get coined nature's dirty needle because their mouth parts act like a needle. And so they go into the human and they express chemicals that will thin the blood and anesthetize the skin, because it doesn't do them any good if whatever they're trying to feed off of notices that they're there. So they want to be stealthy. And a lot of times, you know, people are going to get bit and have no idea that they were bit because they won't feel it. And it'll be on an area of their body that they're not looking at or able, like it's not, you know, readily seen. It might be in the hair, the hairline, the back, you know, in all sorts of places. And so the tick, when it feeds off of the next being after feeding off of one initially that it gets infected with, but when they take in the blood meal and they inhale and kind of take in some of the blood, and then they kind of will regurge the contents of their stomach back out, sort of like pumping it in and pumping it out. Because you'll notice a tick can be very, very small, but once it's attached onto something, they get very, very big.
Right.
And they get, you know, and it's hard to even tell what species it is sometimes between a dog tick and a deer tick. And there's a difference in what's transmitted with those as well. A lot of times patients will be denied care from a tick bite because the attachment time isn't long enough. But I don't know many people that watch a tick bite them, you know, and totally yeah. embed and then go, I got 24 hours or so. It's cool. I'll just leave it there. You know, yes, the longer the tick stays on the skin or embedded, the transmission is risk is greater. But there's a lot of different factors of like where the bug is in the tick, in the mouth parts or in the gut. And also there's a lot of chemical stuff going on with the exchange between the tick and the human that allows that to be transferred from the tick to the human. And so when spirochetes go into the body, they're a little, like when you see pictures of the Lyme Borrelia spirochete, it's like a little corkscrew. And when they come into the system, some go into the bloodstream, but others sort of just by nature of how they're shaped, they're like little corkscrews and they can move through walls or move through into the tissue. They're migrators. They're mobile and modal. And so we usually, when we think about Lyme, we think about the EM rash or the bullseye rash. Only about 30% of people that get bit get that. And actually, when you do get that, that's a blessing, because then you know that you've been, that something's happened. If you didn't see a tick there, you would otherwise have no idea, potentially, and then start feeling sick a couple weeks later and have nothing to connect it to at all. But the bullseye rash is just a representation of those spirochetes swimming out from the bite site and the body's inflammation response to that.
Wow.
But then they just start to migrate. And so spirochetes aren't really doing much in the body as far as like, you know, they're not like, they might release chemicals or do stuff or kind of, you know, just their mere presence is actually more what causes a lot of the symptoms with Lyme, because Lyme goes in and it's basically has no boundaries. So, you know, a lot of infections have their boundaries. You know, you've got respiratory infections that stay in the respiratory tract. You've got urinary tract infections that stay in the bladder or in the kidneys or localized in the skin or in the gut. Spirochetes just, they don't care. They're going to go everywhere. They've got, it's like no boundaries and they move really fast. They can, you know, move faster than your immune cells going after them. And the body doesn't like pathogen being places where it's not used to seeing things. And so when it sees something there and it can't quite kill it, it's just going to keep initiating inflammation and trying to attack it, and trying to, the immune system's going to keep trying to like burn it out or attack it with it, with our own cells. But if it can't clear it out, it's just going to keep doing that with you know, without any success. And then we end up, our illness, when we're sick with Lyme and it becomes chronic Lyme, comes from just chronic inflammation. So it's mere presence there. And then over months, years, you know, and as it migrates into different areas, joints, muscles, organ systems like the heart, the liver, the brain, the longer it stays within a human body, it just keeps, you know, migrating and multiplying and going deeper and deeper into tissue.
That makes so much sense. Like, I, you know, instead of it actually being, oh, this is the virus causing these symptoms, the body is just continually trying to attack it, which causes chronic inflammation. Chronic inflammation can cause chronic fatigue and then, you know, joint pain. And then, gosh, in the brain fog and all those unfortunate symptoms we hear people struggle with, that makes so much sense. So let me ask you this, and this is the other big Lyme question, because, you know, even people in my family, it's like, okay, is it Lyme? Maybe your Hashimoto's is actually a underlying chronic, being triggered by chronic Lyme. Are there reliable tests to figure out if you have Lyme disease? It seems like every test that people talk about, somebody else has to say, no, that's not actually a reliable test. And even if it isn't positive or is negative, that can't really rely on that. So what do you think?
So I think it's the whole picture. I think that there are tests out there that are more sensitive to pick it up and that are more aware of the fact that there are different pieces of data to be able to assess whether someone has it or not. So there's kind of two camps. There's CDC guidelines that are fairly strict. And again, I'm not anti-CDC by any measure, but there are definite limitations to how Lyme disease is viewed and how doctors can treat their patients with what is currently sort of the current belief about that or set of criteria for treatment. I belong to a collection of doctors with a group called ILADS, and I have for most of my career. And it's a collection of doctors, MDs, DOs, nurse practitioners, nurses, naturopathic doctors that kind of treat on a different set of criteria and have a different viewpoint that really looks at it more from what is effective at getting the patient better, and also looking at the constellation of symptoms along with lab work. Right now, there's, when somebody goes in to get lab work done for Lyme, currently the CDC requires something called two-tiered testing. So they're required to get, when you go to like a standard hospital or a doctor's office, you might, you know, have the something called an ELISA screen first. So they want to try to kind of try to pick up something that shows that Lyme might be there. And then they will move on to the confirmatory test for Lyme, which is the Western blot. And so you have to be positive for the first one in order to get to the second one. Now, the first one's supposed to be super, super sensitive. You know, like, you know, typically when we do a screen test, it should be about 80%, you know, sensitive or 90%. There's data out there to show that the ELISA really is only about 30 to 40% efficient at picking up Lyme. But then, you know, they won't, if it's negative, it's a false negative, it won't move on to the Western blot. So I typically will, I just run the Western blot, whether somebody pays out of pocket for that or if insurance pays for it through a standard lab. And a lot of times people come in saying, no, my doctor just kept getting negatives and negatives and negatives. If I just run simply the Western blot, even through like a standard lab, like LabCorp Quest, that is, you know, a national lab company, both of them, they'll be positive for Lyme. But also you also have to look at co-infections. So it's not just about Lyme. Ticks carry several different infections, and you can get infected by several infections with one bite. Or you can, if you live somewhere that's endemic with ticks, you can get bit several times throughout your life, and you get a little bit of this infection here and a little bit of that infection there, and, you know, and then an accumulation. And finally, there's that bite, that one bite where it's just enough, and then your whole body just goes, you know, has a terrible, you know, a very heightened immune response to it and all the symptoms. And you think, oh, I just got bit. It's brand new. You know, you don't have the typical recovery from that, right? You don't just get over it in a couple of weeks with antibiotics. It seems to be something that's like life-changing. It's usually that somebody's had bites, you know, maybe several bites over the years and sort of ignored symptoms and kind of put them, you know, like, oh, well, I'm older. I should have joint pain, or, you know, I have these headaches. Well, you know, people get headaches. I'll just take my ibuprofen, or, you know, or I'm really tired or I can't think clearly. And so we kind of just shove that away and keep going, or we take something to just keep going. So it is complex in that regard, but as far as testing, there, again, there are standard labs that are covered by insurance that are run by labs that are, you know, the, with labs across the country, like, again, that you would find in most doctor's offices. There are also specialty labs that look at it more in depth, typically like Vibrant Wellness, Tick-Borne Panel, or Igenix is another company. Unfortunately, most of the time people have to pay out of pocket for those tests because they're not covered by insurance, but they give a lot more pieces of information. They look at more proteins that the body would create to prove or to give clarification and that Lyme is there, and, or confirmation, I should say. That's how I would go about it in the office. But it also is a it's the whole symptom picture. So when you've got people who come in with symptoms in their one person, and this is all happening to them at the same time. They've got neurologic symptoms, gastro symptoms, heart palpitations, chest pain. They've got muscle pain, joint pain, difficulty with vision and hearing, memory, focus. They've already been to see a gastroenterologist, an endocrinologist, a neurologist, a cardiologist, you know, the list goes on before even seeing me. There's not many conditions where all systems like that would be impacted at one time. Now, you kind of asked about like Hashimoto's thyroiditis and like different other conditions. You can have Lyme and you can also have autoimmune diseases. You can have MS at the same time while you have Lyme, but you can also have Lyme look like MS and look like Parkinson's and look like ALS, early stages of ALS. So it does get a little, the waters get a little bit muddy if someone has a long-term infection like that. And we talked about the long-term inflammation and kind of living with a pathogen for a long time and not even knowing it's there, that, you know, you can develop these conditions after years of having that pathogen in the body, especially if you have genetic predisposition. So if you have a family history of, you know, thyroid issues, of MS, neurologic issues, that, you know, it's just going to, that stress on the body is going to just kind of turn that on, turn on right. Those genetics earlier in life. Like maybe those would start to come up when you're in your 30s or 40s instead of, you know, you would have gotten that in your 70s or 80s. So, and that also can be rheumatoid arthritis and all sorts of things like that. So you can have, it's not just one or the other, you can have both. And so labs can also help with being able to show, you know, someone may be fully lit up with Lyme disease, but also have all the criteria for rheumatoid arthritis and all the presentation for that. And so then both need to be treated at the same time. But if you treat tick-borne infection, you can kind of slow down the progression, deactivate, and kind of calm everything down for rheumatoid, or at least have that person have a much better quality of life. And maybe they don't need as much medication or herbs and all that stuff to be able to manage RA.
So do all kids and adults who get bit by a tick and that tick has Lyme disease, are they going to eventually end up being symptomatic?
There are a lot of people walking around out there that have Lyme that are not symptomatic. So it also is kind of like our bodies can handle stuff. Like it can handle having a little bit of this and a little bit of that. Our immune system can handle that and not get activated. We can handle being around a little bit of mold here and maybe have a little bit of, you know, mercury in our fish and have a little bit, you know, and plastics and all that stuff. We can handle that. But then when the bucket gets too full of all of those things, then at a certain point, the baseline, you know, something's going to get triggered. There's going to be a hairpin trigger. There's going to be the body can only handle so much. And then boom, when it hits that point, it turns on those cascades.
Love that. Yeah, that's such a good visual. I love the bucket analogy because people always want to create singular focused disease diagnosis treat. You know, it's like, I have this, I treat it with this, as opposed to you've had a lot of things and then finally something was the trigger. So before we jump into, I have some more questions about, chronic infections. I know that this is so individual and I'm sure, you know, this could be an entire podcast in and of itself, but how do you treat Lyme disease? And I have seen a lot of people say, you know, if you get the bullseye rash, you need to immediately go on antibiotics. And a lot of us are not really, you know, it's hard. We don't want to jump into antibiotics for no reason. But I've seen that debate on Facebook, you know, like I have the rash, do I do it? And people are like, you need to do it. You need to do it. And people are like, well, wait and see and get the testing. So what says you?
Well, especially if you have a bullseye rash and you there's any question that you might have been bit by a tick, like even if you didn't see it in your skin, or if you did and you're just kind of waiting to see if you develop symptoms, but you have a ring, you do need to be treated, because that's definitely a sign that you've been infected. And the long-term ramifications of being on an antibiotic for, you know, I usually treat 4 weeks, 4 to 6 weeks with a bite that's, you know, with either a symptomatic bite, a ring, or if a tick, if someone sends out a tick and it gets tested and it's positive, because the long term, you know, we think in terms of like a treatment for chronic Lyme can go 1 to 2 years or more. It can go years to try to recover, and it will drain people's bank accounts. It will devastate families. It'll cause pain and suffering, and it will change the course of someone's life to be able to be a functioning human being, a child from being able to develop properly. And so debating about whether to have a 2 to 4 week course of antibiotics when you have a pretty good idea that you've been infected is a no-brainer to me. And especially if you live somewhere that's endemic, because you can take some high-dose probiotics. As long as you don't have an allergy to that medication, your gut will survive. The gut can take a bit of a beating and it can come back and it can thrive. When you're looking at the risk to benefit there of developing the long-term impact of the to the body and to the overall like social structure and financial structure of your home and, you know, your family. So I do treat with antibiotics with both acute new bites and also with long-term chronic infections. I also treat with herbals. I treat with homeopathy. I treat with IV therapies. I treat with magnetic therapies and energy medicine. You know, it really takes a lot of, you know, for individuals that are farther down the road with their symptoms, it takes multiple modalities and kind of a team approach and looking outside the box to help people through the process. So I bring in all the tools, I guess I should say, because it's such a complex infection that the better you are and the more trained you are in understanding everything that's available that can help someone get well is really the best way through it. You can't just be strictly antibiotics, because then yes, you will, the body, the gut and the body overall will not recover from that if it's not supported with its detox pathways and anti-inflammatory support and especially the GI. There are people who strictly come in to see me for a therapy called biomagnetic pair therapy, which is using muscle testing and placing magnets on the body in order to help the body clear and heal from infection, and without any intake of any medication at all. So, or they make them in for ozone and do oxygen therapy for the kill effect of ozone. So, you know, with, as far as their immune system and helping them recover and not do anything internally that they're taking in to their gut. So yeah, I kind of bring in multiple tools is, I guess, the long and the short of it there.
Yeah. Now that I am approaching 40, I have been using adaptogens to manage stress, lack of sleep, and cycle changes, especially during cold and flu season when the kids are up all throughout the night. I love supplementing with ashwagandha mid-morning to help my body manage stress or lack of sleep, or even when we're traveling. I also love Vitex or Chasteberry. There is so much research on how it helps relieve PMS symptoms like headaches and mood changes and even cycle irregularities. And the only place I get adaptogen blends is from Organifi. They have clinical doses of adaptogen blends, and they make them in really good tasting drinks. Adaptogens are herbs and functional mushrooms that help your body adapt to stress. Research shows adaptogens can balance cortisol, combat fatigue, enhance focus, ease depression and anxiety, and support proper hormone function. Organifi's green juice blend has ashwagandha, and Harmony is perfect for you to take around your cycle if you're struggling with PMS or want to balance hormones. And new this month, Organifi just launched Kids Easy Greens. This is awesome for picky eaters or when you just want to supplement your kids' diet with superfood greens, micronutrients, and antioxidant-rich digestive and immune support. It's a nutrient-rich blend of veggies and superfoods with added probiotics and digestive enzymes. It tastes amazing, and you can just tell your kid it's juice. Support your body, energy, immunity, and stress with Organifi. Organifi takes pride in offering the best tasting superfood products on the market at a price that works out to less than $3 a day. There are clinical doses of adaptogens so you actually feel the difference. Go to Organifi.com/wellfed and use code WellFed for 20% off. That's Organifi, Organifi.com/wellfed. Use code WellFed for 20% off your entire order.
I love it. I was telling you earlier, I was looking at your website. I'm like, gosh, I wish she was near closer to me, because there's a lot of stuff that I would love to do, like ozone therapy and all that kind of stuff. I saw you do red light therapy and Yeah. I mean, it's a multifaceted approach. This is a question we're all asking. This is from Alyssa. She says, I live in Vermont, and just like a lot of places, the ticks are horrid here. You can pick two off after going outside for 5 minutes. Do you have any recommendations for natural yard treatment? I have a natural body spray that works pretty well. I think she's talking about for her kids. I just want to lay in the lawn and get some sun without crawling with nasty bugs. And this reminds me, when my kid was, we used to live on a tree line, and there used to be, deer that used to go back and forth. Luckily, we've moved from there. And since then, I haven't had a tick on me, but I found a tick on my 9-month-old, who's now 6. And it felt like such an offense. I was like, how dare you? My kid's just crawling around outside. Like, that's what we all natural holistic moms want. We want our kids on the ground and crawling. So how do we, what's the balance of putting natural stuffs, maybe not so natural stuff, like treating our clothes and being able to hang out outside?
So, I typically, if you live somewhere where just going to your mailbox, it's that intense. My family and other families typically will kind of do a combination of wearing treated clothing and then, treating the land. And the land itself, I usually recommend treating in and around the perimeter of where you're spending the most time. In New Hampshire, people tend to have a lot of acres and also tend to be bordering woods. You can't go spraying the whole world and protect yourself. So there are companies that do natural formulations and also stuff you can buy for yourself. So like cedar oil, garlic, essential oils. There are companies that have essential oil blends that they'll come out and spray. And of course, there's permethrin and different chemical compounds that get sprayed. And normally the application has to be repeated, and especially with natural ones, that needs to be repeated. The natural ones, they're effective because they have an odor that drives the ticks away. So there's two things. There's permethrin that kills them, or it's basically a neurotoxin to them that gets put. We can saturate clothes with that and wear clothes, or send them off to a company like Insect Shield or other companies where they'll treat the clothes for you and send them back, and you wear them and you can wash. You can get several washes out of them. And a lot of times families, that's what they'll do. And then they'll have their kid that they'll have a box, and like when their kids go out to play or they go out to go do something, those are just the outfits for that. And then when they come in, those clothes are off, they're in the shower, tick checks, all that stuff. Yeah. And then they get back into their normal clothes. Or if they work in a job where they're like land surveyors or they're contractors or they're, landscapers, that, you would wear those clothes outside because you can't be not in the elements. But for the land, permethrin gets used, typically applied once a month or maybe once every few months. And again, that's a nerve. That's something that it's like toxic to them, but it's also going to be toxic to other insects as well. And even ones that we want to have in our yard, pollinators. I'm a beekeeper. So, very tuned in with like the pollinating and not just bees that are pollinators. We've got multiple pollinators. The natural stuff needs to be applied more frequently. But a couple ways that ticks find us is that a big one is smell. So they can't see or hear, but they can smell, and that's really their main scent. And that's how they move about the world. And so they can perceive our CO2 emissions, and they can perceive, they can smell that on us. And there are going to be individuals who, you have those friends that like, you'll be out with them and they'll have all the ticks and you won't have any on you. They're kind of like the tick magnets and are getting them like every couple of weeks. Everybody's all in the same place. Some people just have kind of a pheromone that ticks like. But when we wear stuff on our bodies, like the essential oil sprays, I would say from a natural standpoint, and what has the most kind of, I guess, the most validation behind it is Sawyer has a spray. You can get it on Amazon or, just go online, but it has an active ingredient called picardin in it, and it's derived from black pepper. Okay. And you want something that's at least 20%, and that can be applied to the skin. And there's actually a video out there from Consumer Reports. If you do a Google search on Consumer Reports, they have a video where they kind of compared it to DEET, and they compare it to like all the like off brand and then other like botanical formulations, essential oil formulations. And this one, they had basically had people put their hand in a box with ticks and mosquitoes that were, not infected with anything. Basically, and with the DEET and then with the other sprays, and then what it came down to is the hand in the box with the picardin, the ticks didn't, they like had this buffer, like they wouldn't come any closer pretty consistently. And so that was determined that the picardin was pretty fairly effective. We want them to like stay away from us. A tick can be like crawling on you. As long as it doesn't enter your skin, it's just another bug crawling on you. It hasn't done anything to you yet. So if things that we use keep them, just from coming into, coming near us, that's fine. The ticks can be who they want to be out there, as long as they're not like on us and infecting us, right? They're just trying to live.
Let the ticks live their lives. Just let not them live on their me. Lives.
They're part of the world. But you know, so permethrin, yard, clothes, no skin. Picardin, skin. Got it. Just want to make clear.
I did write it down, and I will link to the stuff in the show notes as well. So we will have it all correct. So I want to switch gears. I want to address pans and pandas because in my research, this can actually be connected to Lyme infections. I think a lot of women are talking about it more, especially holistic influencers. I know a few who have actually had kids who have developed pans and pandas. I know a lot of us pretty familiar with it. And for me in particular, I've tried to make myself aware of it because of strep. And strep infections are just things that kids are going to get multiple times. Sometimes you miss it. Sometimes you don't. And that is another fear of mine. But I want to know a little bit more about now. And you know, the more research I did, the more confused I got, to be quite honest, because I was like, wait, it cannot be strep. It could be something else. It could just be a random virus. And all of a sudden my kid gets it. So what are the most common symptoms of pans and pandas, and where does it actually come from?
I think truly they can be multiple pathogens that cause the issue because of a leaky brain and a leaky gut. And so, because it's when infection or toxins are able to pass through and or land or turn on inflammation in certain parts of the brain that impact children's behavior. So you're mostly going to see a change in the nature of who your child is, the child you knew versus who they turn into. And it can happen from one day to the next. But pretty like the criteria is usually the development, that the rapid onset of OCD. So things need to be a very certain way. Children of all ages, you know, that get inflicted with this are terribly boxed in with like fears and worries, or having to do things a certain way, having the house needing to be a certain way, you know, closing doors or repeating statements, OCD around food. So control around certain foods, food restriction, you know, only eating one or two things, or being afraid of things touching each other, or, you know, really like over the top and then leading to either not eating or a very limited diet, which again is not healthy for the child either. If they're just eating like two or three foods. The other is going to be tics. So parts of the brain that get inflamed, if children start to develop like lip smacking, like, and like kind of rolling their eyes back or doing kind of a head tilt, or repetitive behaviors that seem, you know, kind of like eyebrows raising, or repeating statements, kind of a Tourette's like symptoms as well. And then also onset of bedwetting. So if your child was fully potty trained, you know, and again, if your child was potty trained at, you know, like one or two, or it's not unusual for kids to not be fully potty trained until they're three or four, but and still need pull-ups and things like that. But if they had an extended period of time of dry, and then some, you know, they get strep, or like one of their siblings gets strep, or another family member, and then all of a sudden, even if that child didn't manifest symptoms of strep with the sore throat and the immune response to try to, you know, basically get it under control before it encroaches anywhere else on the body, right? So like the tonsils get lit up and get very painful. It tries to kind of deal with the infection to encapsulate it and to like try to get it cleared up before it encroaches any farther on the system. A lot of times kids with pandas and pans don't get those symptoms, but their sibling will, or kids at school will, and then they'll start to manifest the neurological symptoms that I just talked about. They'll get a flare, a pandas flare. And this will typically go up and down. So they'll be fine, and then other children around them will get sick. I typically refer to them as neurovulnerable. So it really does stem from, I think, from a leaky blood-brain barrier. And then we talk about the bucket again. So again, strep was probably one of the first infections that was noted in regards to seeing a dramatic change in children's, in these changes in the psychiatric, you know, in psychiatric symptoms, neuropsychiatric symptoms, and behavioral issues. But when you also look at other infections, PANS is sort of like the category where all the other infections go. So pandas is just strep, but PANS is like everything else. And okay. And again, from the main ones I see in my office, again, this is an emerging field and there's so much more to know. I can, you know, I'm kind of glossing over it by saying a leaky blood-brain barrier. I think there's many other things we don't understand and that, you know, need to have further research to really get a handle on how children are ending up with these types of symptoms. And it also does go into adulthood, but children are so striking because they're living one way, bump-a-dump-a-dump, and then all of a sudden they're totally different, like just overnight. But PANS infections are going to be, what I commonly see is mycoplasma pneumonia. So that's walking pneumonia. And that is I've seen a lot more post-COVID.
But do you think the actual COVID infection is doing something to our immune systems, or yes. It has done something. Okay.
Yes. I think spike protein, we talk a lot about spike protein. Again, this is again an emerging field. So what I might say now might be totally, totally something different that comes out in the research, a year from now or 6 months from now. But something's happened to our blood, our microcirculation. We know that COVID can cause damage to the microcirculatory system. You know, we want a spike protein as a primary antibody from COVID. I'm sure a lot of us have heard that term or what that is. When we have too much of it, or if the body can't get rid of it, then it's just going to be another burden on the body. We need the right amount in order to have immunity, which, you know, trying to achieve with, you know, if you chose to vaccinate your children or yourself, you know, what you're trying to do is create an antibody response. And so you'll see like elevated spike protein in blood levels in individuals that have had either, you know, both COVID and the vaccination or just the vaccination or just COVID. But I think that was just another thing that came that has been dumped into the bucket. And because of it's encroachment on the circulatory system and the nervous system. So that infection coming up to the sinuses, there's no blood-brain barrier in the nasal bone. And this pathogen, you know, then this virus, you know, there's still more research to be done. But in regards to the neuroinflammation it can cause, we see it in people with long-haul COVID, brain fog, changes in, you know, like increased anxiety, depression, memory loss, or, you know, all sorts of different neurologic changes with the long-term effects from that. And that's because of the virus impacting the brain, and other viruses do the same. So with kids with PANDAS, Coxsackie virus, herpes viruses, from a bacterial standpoint, Lyme, Bartonella is another tick-borne infection, Babesia, and also Candida. So mold and fungus, and mold and fungus is something that doesn't get as much attention, but it plays a huge role in agitating both an adult and a child's mind and body.
So many places I want to go from this, but my glaring question is, there's got to be, so every mom listening is probably like, well, my kid does some of that stuff. So what is the spectrum? Because I think some kids have some little OCD behaviors, yeah. And us as moms tend to overthink that. We see them lining up their toys, or we see them being picky with food, or all of a sudden they have a little bit of a fear. And so they start kind of like, they've got to, like my daughter says, she wants to say the same things back and forth at night before, you know, and it's a lot of it is just growing up and learning about, or just, you know, the fear of like being alone at night. I totally get all that stuff. But like, where is the line? Where is it? Okay, this is now abnormal behavior that isn't as typical and might be a PANS or PANDAS infection.
You know, you might see small things and it could be due to infection or illness, but it's not so disruptive to the household or disruptive to the child's life. And it could be due to just their brain sort of responding to either mold, like mold at school or in a gym that they work out at, or something that's happened in the home or being at a family member's house and having exposure and then kind of just feeling a little off and behaving a little odd or eating something. You know, like we all know that our kids, if they eat a bunch of candy, especially with all the dyes and everything, they're going to be off the wall. And then, you know, kind of just not even be hearing us or being able to like interact, you know, like trying to get them to calm down. Or if your child's sensitive to gluten or something like that they get a little bit off the rails. But these are conditions where it's above, like, you know, your child may communicate to you, I don't want to sleep alone, I'm scared, or they might see them sort of repeating themselves because they like to hear themselves talk, especially when they're toddlers and they kind of just, you know, it's fun and they're making noises and they're just kind of figuring themselves out, or they get kind of fixated on something, or they kind of want to see how things work. But if they can move with grace and ease to like the next thing, or if something seems like they're getting hyper fixated on it, but then they can kind of easily, a mom or dad or a teacher or something like that can be like, hey, well, gosh, that looks like fun what you're doing. How about we go focus over here? And they're kind of able to pull back and calmly and like listen, or just maybe they won't like it, but it's more of a typical toddler response or a young child response of like being frustrated, but they still sort of can rein themselves in and self-regulate. Kids with PANDAS and PANS, they're behaving in ways that are horrifying to them. Like children will, you know, be very, you know, they can at the very extreme, be very violent with their siblings, with their parents, violent with their language, irritable, defiant, like significant oppositional defiant, where, you know, not even, they care less about a punishment or care less about this or that. And then the whole household kind of gets built around trying to maneuver around the needs of the child with their with their kind of their rules and their restrictions, and to try to keep the child from getting like initiated into an episode of rage or anger. When you see something go from like just this to that, versus a child sort of having some growth and development stuff, and kind of just, and then you can talk with them about it and they maybe go through the phase, but it's not completely disruptive to the household or to the child's life.
I have a way for you to get free electrolytes, and let me be honest, you are going to love them. Minerals have quite literally changed my life. I take them daily now. A lot of people think that you don't need to take them during the winter because you're not sweating as much, but that's a myth. If you are running around, if you're working out, if you're eating a whole foods diet, and if you're dealing with stress, your body still needs electrolyte support. In fact, I'm still drinking them daily during the winter now. I tend to drink them mid-morning. I get to a point where I start to feel fatigue, and I actually start to feel like I want something, like I'm craving something, whether it's food or sweet, and I don't really feel hungry. That's when I know I need my electrolytes. One of my favorite ways to replace minerals is with Element. I started supplementing with Element after workouts, and it made a huge difference in my energy and the dizziness I used to experience throughout the day. They make grab-and-go electrolyte replacement packs with no sugar, gluten fillers, or artificial ingredients. You just tear open a pack, pour it into your water, and stir. I have now been mixing up half a packet for my kids when they're sick, which has been often. They now say, I don't feel good, I want my Element. I also pretty much always have one in my purse because when we are out and about, it's been a long day, we're at a football game, I need to pour some Element in my water. Right now, everyone, including new and current customers, can get a free 8-pack of Element with every order. Element comes in boxes of 30. There is free shipping on all orders, and now all orders will get a free 8-pack, which has all the flavors of Element. When you do your order, I recommend doing the Insider Bundle, which gives you 3 boxes, then you get one free, then you get a free 8-pack on top of it. And make sure to check out the new winter flavors, chocolate mint, chocolate raspberry, and chocolate chai, which can be heated up for a warm drink. To get Element, go to drinklmnt.com/wellfed and make sure to use the code WELLFED for your free sample 8-pack. Again, that's drinklmnt.com/wellfed.
I'm assuming that a lot of kids end up getting misdiagnosed or the root cause is not actually addressed, because a lot of kids, let's say a child gets diagnosed with OCD. How often is that OCD coinciding with a chronic infection like PANS or PANDAS or being caused by something like that? I mean, how would a parent know?
You probably, when these things come up, especially again, when it's, if your child, you know, has tendencies, and they've always had tendencies, they were kind of born that way and you kind of saw it coming along and it's just who they are. And it seems to be like just, and they may, you would take them to a psychiatrist or a prescriber or someone to evaluate them, to diagnose it formally. And maybe it's determined that a medication is what's going to be best to help that child be more healthy and happy in the world and more free of things like OCD behaviors, if it's really restrictive. And they have a wonderful response to that medication. You know, they feel the burden lifted, they're behaving better, there really isn't any other issue, and the medication is really helping. And then that just might be its own organic OCD cause. It's just part of their temperament or their brain chemistry. A lot of times when it's infection related, or again, the big piece of this too that we haven't talked about is the moldy environment. So if you've got infection blended with a mold exposure, which I typically see, that's where I see the most escalated cases, is when parents are unaware of some sort of mold exposure that the child is having, or they know that their home has mold issues, but in these times with what things cost and what it takes to to remediate a place or to go down that rabbit hole, or if they're renting or all that kind of stuff in housing right now, they can be stuck in situations that they can't fix it, and it impacts the whole family. It's also going to, so in this case with, like, let's say OCD, kind of circling back to that, you would think of a secondary cause like an illness or a toxin with a very poor response to what would typically, from a medication standpoint, work. So, you know, you might try OCD medications, or you might try herbs or things that would calm down the neurochemistry, nutrients that would calm down the neurochemistry. Look at the gut, take food intolerances out, and try all those things. And if that doesn't work, well, gosh, okay, now we got to look at the bigger picture of illnesses. But of course, if the child has known tick bites, known exposure to environmental toxins, like a significant exposure to environmental toxins, because we're all exposed, as we were talking about earlier, right?
Yeah.
You know, you would want to probably look at both. So yes, go see a child psychologist, a psychiatrist, go get evaluated by a neurologist, you know, seek out that perspective. And then I would also work with a functional medicine doc or a pediatrician that's open to having conversations about PANDAS PAN.
Yeah. So let's talk about ADHD a little bit. I have a lot of questions relating to ADHD and kids because, as you know, man, our system is really all about, as early as five, kids are supposed to sit in class all day. And so I think a lot of moms are struggling with, okay, I have a hyperactive child, or I have a child that the school is telling me isn't able to sit and listen. And what do I do? And what's this line? So Bethany asks, what's the line between an active child and ADHD? What are signs to watch out for? And a few other people have asked, you know, how can we boost focus in kids and attention in toddlers? And what are normal attention spans versus what's something that's abnormal? And when is something like a warning sign with ADHD?
Well, honestly, if the child is suffering in any way and showing signs of anxiety, again, school refusal, maybe not as severe as I was just talking about, or outward behavior because they're either bored or because they need to move their bodies or because they're overwhelmed by the stimuli. And, you know, especially when it comes to like trying to sit down with them and do homework and they're hard on themselves. They even at a young age, even though it might not be spoken in your home at all, any words of criticism around learning, they might say that they're dumb or that they're stupid and they can't do this or that, or it might manifest into anxieties around that because they just don't know what to do with the sensory aspect of things or the ability to hold focus. And they realize that it's not very welcomed and that teachers might have a hard time with them or that they are labeled the difficult kid. I tend to treat it with, like, again, the cases that I see where there's ADHD involved, just, again, this is just my wheelhouse and kind of what I do here, that I would start looking at areas of anything we can do to help. Is there any other organic cause that's contributing to this child being, their brain being agitated and unable to focus? Where I would kind of look at it is like, okay, are there foods that this child is taking in that's triggering their brain and making it hard for them to focus? Like gluten, dairy, do a lot of food intolerance testing. Are there any pathogens growing in the gut that are contributing to that? And again, agitating the brain, because the gut and the brain are very closely related. They're like sister and brother. You know, that we have the same nerve tissue in the gut that we do in the brain. We have the same neurotransmitters, you know, more lymphatic tissue in the gut than anywhere else in the body, because it has to kind of read the outside world and what it's allowing in. And so if there's inflammation in the gut, then it's going to allow proteins through that are going to be neuro triggering to the child and make it hard for them to think. Does their classroom have mold in it? And so when the kids go to school, and then maybe they got multiple teachers, is it always the same teacher in the same room that's saying they're all over the place, but no other teacher has that complaint. And it always seems to be that same classroom, because there's been multiple times with kids that have had, you know, issues, and parents come in and I'm like, well, is there any mold in the school? And the parents like, oh no, school's great. And the kid is like, mom, there's water stains in my classroom, or in my science class, or in my economics class, you can smell mold when you go in there, and I have a headache and I feel, I can't think. And then I get agitated, and then it takes me the rest of the day to recover. I mean, teenagers, usually they're going to be the ones that are going to talk like that, or like a child that's like 8 or 9 or older, but there'll be floods at the school. And again, with limited funding, most of the time it's going to be, fix whatever caused the leak, put some duct tape on it, you know, paint over it and call it a day. But as far as fully getting rid of anything that had mold toxicity on it, or taking care of slow leaks and things like that, they're just, you know, kids might be in classrooms with that happening. I've had patients take it like where they're trying to figure out where this is coming from, especially families that have already remediated their home, but their child seems to still be struggling. If they found mold in the home, and we've had plenty of time for like the brain to deactivate and the body to feel better, and other people are feeling better in the household, but there's one or two kids that are just still not, you know, still struggling. Parents have bought like those plates at Home Depot, the little kits, and have them take them to school and have the kids kind of set them out on the desk, kind of be cool about it. And just like, science experiment, and then do one at the house and send me pictures. And it's like the one at school looks like a blooming, like penicillin farm in their classroom. So these are things to think about too. Like the teacher might be really frustrated. She might have it's like a terrible year this year. All my kids in my class, it's like, they don't pay attention to anything. Well, maybe it's just the room itself and not the kids. And then my kids were born right when the iPhone was developed, right? And so we have kids on screens and looking at things that are moving fast, clicking between screens at a very young age. And it's very different in families. I know that, you know, Ideally, you don't want kids to be looking at that stuff until later. But with TV and all that stuff, it just is. It's in our environment. The best we try limit that. But that's going to change the nervous system's expectation of how fast things should be going and how quickly, and also getting that fed, like wanting things to be faster. You know, like the brain is just working on that pace. But then when you go to class and that teacher's at a different pace, but your dopamine receptors are used to getting like fed from, you know, doing stuff on the phone or the iPad or a video game or even just, again, watching a TV show. If you look at TV shows from the 1980s, I'm almost 50 years old. So, you know, in the 80s, and you compare that to like, you know, like Little House on the Prairie, that they'd be like a long screenshot and the story would be a little slow. Yeah. Watch it now and it seems like really slow. And then we watch like a current TV show and it's like screen, 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 change, yeah. You know? And totally. So
I've noticed that.
And our kids have not known a world without that. And so there's multiple reasons and that children end up being in that state. But it really, again, it all comes down to, I think, the term neurovulnerability. And EMFs, like, don't even get me started on EMFs, true. And things like that. And not to, you know, not to be tinfoil hat, but that is a thing. And so there's many different variables in regards to that. And it is hard to negotiate that within the schools. I talk to a lot of parents that's just like, my kid needs to go to school and the school's pressuring me to put my child on medication. And I need to comply. If I'm not complying, I look like I'm not being a good mom. I'm I'm not doing what medically I'm supposed to do, yet they're completely conflicted about, you know, and they're heartbroken that this is, you know, that they have to go this route in order to keep their kid matriculating through the school system. There are nutrients that are helpful. And again, getting the underpinning is going to be really looking at any other areas that there's inflammation with infection, toxins, foods, and making those changes. And oftentimes you can see enough change just in that, with children being able to like self-regulate and see their own behavior and make modifications. And they might still have the kind of, that might just be part of who they are, part of that energy, but being able to read the room and know when to do that and when not to do that, and being able to self-regulate.
I have two last questions about gut health, and one of them is very related. So if you find that, I think most of the people listening are very familiar with food intolerances and how things like artificial colorings and all that stuff can absolutely influence behavior. We've seen the studies on that. We've seen probably the difference in our kids. And so if you find that your kid, this is from AJW.ATX, she says, how can you help heal the gut for kids with dairy intolerance to work towards reintroduction? I've done fermented foods, probiotics, ion, et cetera, but hoping there's something else out there. So if our kids have a sensitivity to dairy or eggs, is there anything, have you seen in your practice that there's something that can be done to actually help our kids be able to reintroduce that food and have that in their lives?
Sometimes it's going to be one primary food that's going to cause irritation and agitation. And if you take out that one primary food, if it seems like if you do an allergy panel on your kids, like a blood panel to look at IgG food intolerances and IgE, you want to look at both because they're going to both have a different presentation in the body. IgG is going to be more the chronic gut issues, bloating, sinus drainage, kids that have frequent ear infections, eczema, and brain like changes and just how they're, you know, like getting foggy or brain or behavioral stuff. IgE is going to be more rapid response stuff that we think in terms of allergy, you know, like if they start to get tingly mouth or get hivey from, you know, having a certain food or itchy or have an immediate response. Like if they eat dairy and they have an IgE response that, you know, they're running to the bathroom, or, you know, adults and children are like the dairy intolerance. Right. I mean, if you've got really like, you literally just, you might go a year without eating it and you have a little bit of it and all of a sudden you have all these symptoms. Honestly, the only treatment really is going to be coming off of the food, even though dairy's awesome, you know, yeah. You know, and it might also be different aspects of dairy. So a lot of times when I look at food intolerances, I mean, again, just speaking about dairy, but people might be sensitive to whey, which is, whey is that fluffy white, you know, the ice cream and the whipped cream and the sour cream and yogurt, whereas the casein is more cheese. So, you know, your child might be able to have cheese because it's more of the casein and protein and not have a sensitivity to that and get away with it and not be as impacted. But if they go near the liquid stuff and the fluffy white awesomeness, they're, you know, they end up being symptomatic.
I am gluten, that child.
You have that child? Yeah.
No, I am that child.
Oh, you are that child. Yes. So the kids that are dairy intolerant are going to be eczema and ear infections and have had tubes in their ears and all that stuff. So, and usually have all the boogers and the sinus drainage and the, or the gut bloat. Gluten, though, what I tend to find with food intolerance with kids is that gluten actually is more the culprit. And if gluten is removed, then sometimes a lot of times the other sensitivities to like dairy and eggs aren't as bad, because gluten actually, part of its, when people are reactive to it, and it doesn't mean celiac, it just means like there's a gluten intolerance, but it will create inflammation in the gut and kind of clear cut, kind of cut off and kind of peel away or injure the inner lining of the GI, where we can't absorb things as well. And then we get leaky gut. So that means like our gut doesn't have the barrier that it should. And then now foods that we weren't really sensitive to can pass through the GI lining and go into the body and now really just agitate the body and create more inflammation. But if you take away the gluten, the gut gets a chance to heal. Now you can actually introduce other foods. And gluten has become more of an issue too, because mostly gluten-containing grains are going to be reactive because a lot of them are GMO. They've had their, you know, we are not eating the gluten and the grain from like 500 years ago. We're eating a modified grain. Also, they tend to have a lot of mycotoxins in them and glycophosphates and a lot of pesticides. And so though it might not even just be the gluten, it's just the nature of grains in general and other stuff that comes along with it. But if you remove that, then it may allow them to be more universal or more be able to eat more things and have their body tolerate that better.
This is from Archer Holistic. She says, have you seen a big rise in the pathogen bacteria in the gut and overall gut issues in kids today? And I would even say even adults versus years ago. So do you feel like the gut pathogens, infections, bacteria, the gut issues, like are they getting worse?
So in order to assess that, typically there are labs we can do with stool analysis through regular labs, but it's very limited in the pathogens that we can look at. And so typically a lot of labs that look at stool analysis need to be paid out of pocket, and they can range between, you know, $300 or $400, and not every family can do that. But do I see the gut in relationship to so many other aspects of that child's health? And if the gut is not in a healthy place that it can, or if it's not supported, that it can, am I seeing gut issues more often? Yes, but I'm usually seeing children that have a lot of other things going on at the same time, but the gut is part of that. And that again, if the GI is not as strong as it should be, if the GI is disrupted with chemicals, toxins coming in from foods, plastics, things like that, and also there's stress. So the GI issues too, it might not just be pathogen, but chronic stress. I don't know if you've talked on the podcast or, you know, we talk a lot about the vagus nerve and what it is that I do. And the vagus nerve is all about rest and digest. So you've got your system, set up to get you out of trouble. If something's coming up and you got a, you know, something terrifying coming and you need to react and mobilize, you've got your fight or flight. But most of the time we want to be in vagal tone. The vagus nerve is at rest and digest. When everything's right with the world, our homes are safe, we're with our families, we feel okay in the world, we're well fed, we have our needs met, and you know, we're doing okay. We don't have any extraneous stress. If a child is under a lot of stress and A, doesn't talk about it, or you know, has a home that's not very healthy, school system or school situation that's not healthy, or has illnesses like we were talking about that are, you know, triggering, then that vagal tone is going to get impacted. And if the vagal tone is impacted, which I think since 2020, all of our vagal tones have been impacted stress, with chronic stress, then the vagus nerve is what actually propels and mobilizes and gut motility and gut immunity. And so there's been a lot of discussion about in the research around the vagus nerve. If you have poor vagal tone, that you're going to be more susceptible to histamine responses in the GI, so allergic reactions in the GI, something called SIBO, which is the migration of gut bugs. So gut bugs, with this question, there are bugs that we take in on food that are not meant to be in here at all, and your body will have an immune response to try to get rid of it, or it'll live there and kind of take up space and be a problem. But a lot of the times it's our own bacteria that's our beneficial bacteria. But if the vagus nerve or a large amount of stress happens to the GI or the system or the whole body, you'll have migration of that bacteria that if it leaves its little section of the small intestine, you know, like that 1 centimeter that it lives in, and it goes 2 inches to the left or the right, it all of a sudden becomes a pathogen. And if the vagus nerve isn't toned enough, if that child has been under extreme stress, whatever the cause is, for a long period of time, it can start to impact the transmigration and the immunity of the GI. It'll bring down the immunity of the GI and make it more susceptible to things either coming in on food or that don't belong in there, or transmigration of our own healthy flora that now it's responding and reacting to, causing bloating, GI pain, constipation, diarrhea.
Yeah. Got it. Yeah, that's, I can see how that could all be connected. So, okay. So tell me what you're doing right now. Obviously you have a full blown practice. Like we talked about greenhouse medicine. You're in the New England area and you have your own book called Rising Above Lyme Disease. We'll link to that in the show notes, but what are you working on and where can people find more about you or even work with you?
Oh, well, I'm in Amherst, New Hampshire. That's where my practice is. And I'm findable on the internet. I'm here in my office. I'm a clinician. So primarily I do lectures and I love to write and plan to do more of that in the future. But yeah, no, I definitely people can reach out to my clinic and there are other practitioners. There's three other practitioners in my office as well that specialize in what I do and work with the same clientele in order to have more doctors and I train, you know, me helping train more doctors in order to be able to do this, to have that available for people.
Do you currently see people online? Like, are you doing virtual appointments as well?
Yes.
Oh,
yes,
fantastic. Okay, cool. So that's really important. So I think one of the things that's really important and one of the things that's really hard for people is, especially when you think or you suspect you have Lyme disease or you think or you suspect your kid has PANS or PANDAS, is to find, you know, what we'd say is a Lyme literate doctor. And before we jumped on, Dr. Greenspan, we were talking about how hard it is to find doctors who can actually support you and help you kind of understand these things in your area. That is the one thing that I have loved about this post-2020 world is that many doctors now have created these virtual practice opportunities where now if I didn't have a Lyme literate doctor in my area, I now can reach out to one no matter where I am. So I think that's fantastic. And it really, it's such an amazing resource for people who are just stuck and don't know what to do. And they've been turned down by tons of doctors. So I love that.
Well, and I think what coming out of 2020 has kind of done for me is that I've been treating complex chronic illness for a long time and illnesses that one would call like invisible diseases, you know, that you have a hard time finding its place in the world and finding illnesses that are kind of safe where you can have community, you know, support you because these infections don't just go away within a couple of weeks. You know, they're not like a common cold or an infection that you would treat with a couple of weeks of antibiotics or, you know, just get over a cold or a flu. These are things that can take months to years. And so it is also about a doctor that being with doctors that treat these types of conditions and are seasoned in treating these conditions, because the relationship with our patients isn't, you know, we work on the body's timeline and not on like, you should just be over this by now. Like if you're not over this in 2 or 3 months, then it can't be this anymore. And you need to go see a different specialist. It really is about working through it. And it is a long haul. They're called long haul infections for a reason. And I think COVID's actually given that one thing positive that's come out of COVID is that it's given language and a place for a complex illness and a dialogue that's now becoming more of a national dialogue about that and more of an understanding. When I go to, you know, you go to talk to somebody, hey, like I've got long haul COVID. Oh, so sorry. Yes. My cousin has that, you know, whereas years ago, if you said, well, I have long haul Lyme, I have long haul infection from multiple tick-borne infections or from mold infestation at my house and I'm recovering and I've been sick for a couple of years, people would look at you like, aren't you not over that yet? Like maybe you're not doing the right things. Maybe you're not doing, you know, so I think that that's an important piece is that the specialty of doctors like myself across the country, you know, we really work more from a different paradigm when it comes to long haul infections. And that if we've been treating tick-borne infections for years, it's almost like we were kind of training and being ready for this time period now where it's gotten even more complex since COVID got here.
Oh, I love that. Yeah. It's like you've been prepared just for this moment. So yeah.
I didn't realize I didn't have a language for that and understand that until just recently, but it kind of landed of like, oh, okay. Okay. That's so.
Okay. So your practice is, if you guys want to find out more about her, it's greenhousemedicine.com. And right at the top, she said, I can see it's very easy. It says now accepting new patients, which I think is great. So thank you so much for being here, Dr. Greenspan. And hopefully we can have you back on to answer some more of these really complex questions that we got.
I'd be happy to. Thank you so much for having me.
All right. And for more from me, it's coconutsandkettlebells.com. Thanks for being here, guys. I will talk to you next week.